So now I want to go through a timeline, including both. And so you've got a little bit of a picture. I gave you a kind of geographical image for those who are more visually oriented. Now I want to go through a timeline of how all of these things meet up. So we have Ralph Waldo Emerson and William James. These are the main figures that I'm going to focus on. And there's a number of interesting things about them. I mean, first of all, they were both enormously original and creative thinkers. Very, very original thinkers. And also, they both had a passion for cultivating the intellects of other people. They gathered around them these incredible circles of very talented people and really helped to develop their talents and bring out incredible things. They were quite extraordinary that way. And the other thing was they both became national and international celebrities by the time that their lives ended. I mean, Ralph Waldo Emerson, in the beginning of his life, wasn't so well. Neither of them were. Well, William James came from a more well-known family. Emerson didn't come from much. But by the end of his life, when he did his last trip through Europe, he did a trip in Europe and went to Egypt, and he came home. They said hundreds of people came to line the railway track as his train came back from Boston to Concord. He was really a returning hero. I will talk later a little bit about John Dewey, who was very like them in that way, a major celebrity. Ralph Waldo Emerson, they said, when Abraham Lincoln was assassinated, the country was waiting to hear what Emerson had to say about it. And he wrote a piece that they put in the New York Times so that the country would know Emerson's thoughts at the time. When Emerson died, the country wanted to know what William James had to say about it. And he gave a moving eulogy at... it wasn't when he died. It was the anniversary of his birth. It was after he had died. But he gave this moving speech that became nationally known as a memento to the life of Emerson. And supposedly, and John Dewey I know a little less about, but I will learn more. But they said in the first half of the 20th century, there was no topic that could be considered closed in America unless John Dewey had spoken. That he was in intellectual circles the final word. That's going to be a very interesting story that we will get to. I want to go a little bit into the history before I get to the philosophy of what these people were bringing. Emerson was born in 1803 and died in 1882. He lived through something that was kind of like a second birth in America. Because you had the original revolutionary birth, and then you had something like a second birth. And one of the things that I was reading about in the time when Emerson was writing his first books, Andrew Jackson became president. He became president defeating the incumbent, who was John Adams Jr. And John Adams Jr. was the last president, let's put it in the positive. Andrew Jackson was the first president who wasn't really part of the revolutionary generation. He wasn't part of that. There was this kind of a revolutionary aristocracy that had held power until Andrew Jackson. Andrew Jackson was an orphan. I think he was from South Carolina. He drank too much, he gambled too much, he hung out with too many women. He basically came to fame because he was the great general of the War of 1812, and had incredible characteristics, particularly loyalty. And there's a great story about how when he was running for the presidency, of course, the powers that be couldn't believe that he would even have a chance to become president. I mean, this guy was just so out of the league that was supposed to be acceptable as a president you know, that the fact that he was making such a strong showing was really giving people a lot of distress. And then he won. And on Inauguration Day, he came into Washington, and there were crowds, because he was the people's president. You know, he was really popular, you know, he was a real populist. He was very popular with people. And he really encouraged hundreds of people to come in. He had this huge party at the White House on Inauguration Day. They completely trashed the place. They said there were so many people, they couldn't get in the White House. So he ordered the waiters to bring these barrels of spiked punch out into the out into the lawn for the people. But they, as soon as they got to the doorway, they'd be mobbed by these thugs who would kind of tear them away and grab these barrels. And by the time it was done, the furniture was wrecked, the floors were wrecked, and the papers were saying, "See, we are headed for the demise of the country." Now, if that wasn't bad enough, he did something he was a very interesting president. Up until Andrew Jackson, the president was a very secondary figure in government. Congress was the big deal. Congress was the thing. The colonies, up until the Civil War, this country was called these United States. The separation of the states was primary over the unity of the country. It was only after the Civil War that it started to be called the United States. And the president he served an executive function, but his powers were somewhat limited, at least up until Jackson. And Congress was really supposed to be, these were the representatives of the states, and the states were the main event. So Andrew Jackson, of course, comes in. He's the first president kind of not of that ilk. He does something no other president had ever done. He fired everybody. He completely changed the government. I mean, and it's become the norm since him. A new administration comes in, you start fresh. But that hadn't been the case. And so he set a precedent, and his reasoning was, he said, "I am the only elected official who's been elected by all of the people. Everybody else represents a minority faction of a single state. I'm the people's choice, and I have to have, power that..." No, not everyone agreed with him, but he was the man. He had the power. So, he was very popular. I mean, he was enormously popular, so he could get away with it. But he really started some precedent. So there was a kind of a political rethinking. I mean, and he was the right man for the times. There was a lot of challenges because secession was a big issue. He fiercely wanted to hold the country together, and did a lot of important things at the time. So there was a kind of political second wind, so to speak. There was also a religious second wind. This was the time of the great, what's called the Second Great Awakening. I mean, this is kind of, it had been going on for some time, but at the time of Emerson, you had these incredible Protestant revivals happening all over the country. And the basic idea was that the church was in trouble in America because it was losing its grasp on people. And it was losing its grasp because people were moving west and they were spreading all out and there weren't enough churches. And as people got further and further away from church, guess what happened? They didn't go to church anymore and they didn't start caring about church. So the Protestant revivals really worked The Protestant revivals were based on the idea that you didn't need to have a church as your mediator to God. You just needed to have a conversion experience. You needed salvation. And so they would have these revivals, and they'd be all over the country. I mean, even supposedly upstate New York was full of these Protestant revival tent meetings. They set up a tent, and the preachers, who were people who'd been saved themselves, from about a 40-mile or so radius, would all get together in the tent, and they would do 24-hour ministry for about anywhere from 2 to 5 weeks. And everyone would know they're setting up a tent over so-and-so. Everybody's going to... And then with the preachers, part of what they were doing was showing off what they had. And they were trying to get converts to their church, wherever it was. And then they'd go one at a time, and you can kind of imagine. It was quite a scene, and Sometimes there'd be thousands of people in these gigantic structures that would house them, and people would be having these convergent experiences, being saved, falling on the ground. And, you know, and this was the second great awakening. It was the spread of Christianity. And there was another part of the second great awakening, quieter, less people involved, and it was all happening around Harvard University and around Boston, and it was the Unitarian movement. And the Unitarians were, there were English Unitarians, and then there were American Unitarians. And the Unitarians were an interesting church because they said, well, we agree that this kind of Calvinist church structure, all the dogma, we don't go for that. But we think this revivalist conversion experience is just kind of an emotional thing. And their point was, does that emotional conversion to Jesus really lead to transformation? Are people really going to be different just because they had this experience? Because, you know, and they felt, well, no, you need to study, and you need to develop your intellect, you need to understand the scriptures. And of course, Unitarians had a lot of problems with some fundamental clauses of the existing church, the main one being they didn't believe in the Trinity of God, which is why they call themselves Unitarians. They also weren't so crazy about the idea of miracles, because they felt that miracles, well, they don't happen today. Why should we believe they happen some other time? I mean, they must mean something else by miracles.